Chapter 23. Hope.
"Faith, madame," said Sir Andrew, seeing that Marguerite seemed desirous to call her surly host back again, "I think we'd better leave him alone. We shall not get anything more out of him, and we might arouse his suspicions. One never knows what spies may be lurking around these godforsaken places."
"What care I?" she replied lightly. "Now I know that my husband is safe, and I shall see him almost directly."
"Hush!" he said in genuine alarm, for she had talked quite loudly in the fullness of her glee. "The very walls have ears in France these days." He rose quickly from the table and walked round the bare, squalid room, listening attentively at the door, through which Broga had just disappeared, and whence only muttered oaths and shuffling footsteps could be heard. He also ran up the rickety steps that led to the attic, to assure himself that there were no spies of Chauvelin's about the place.
"Are we alone, monsieur?" said Marguerite gaily, as the young man once more sat down beside her. "May we talk?"
"As cautiously as possible," he entreated.
"Faith, man, but you wear a glum face. As for me, I could dance with joy. Surely there is no longer any cause for fear. Our boat is on the beach, the foam crest not 2 miles out at sea, and my husband will be here under this very roof within the next half hour, perhaps. Sure there is naught to hinder us. Chauvelin and his gang have not yet arrived."
"Nay, madam, that I fear we do not know."
"What do you mean?"
"He was at Dover at the same time that we were."
"Held up by the same storm which kept us from starting."
"Exactly. But I did not speak of it before, for I feared to alarm you. I saw him on the beach not 5 minutes before we embarked. At least I swore to myself at the time that it was himself. He was disguised as a curé, so that Satan, his own guardian, would scarce have known him. But I heard him then bargaining for a vessel to take him swiftly to Calais, and he must have set sail less than an hour after we did."
Marguerite's face had quickly lost its look of joy. The terrible danger in which Percy stood, now that he was actually on French soil, became suddenly and horribly clear to her. Chauvelin was close upon his heels. Here in Calais, the astute diplomatist was all-powerful. A word from him, and Percy could be tracked and arrested, and every drop of blood seemed to freeze in her veins. Not even during the moments of her wildest anguish in England had she so completely realized the imminence of the peril in which her husband stood. Chauvelin had sworn to bring the Scarlet Pimpernel to the guillotine, and now the daring plotter, whose anonymity hitherto had been his safeguard, stood revealed through her own hand to his most bitter, most relentless enemy. Chauvelin, when he waylaid Lord Tony and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes in the coffee-room of the Fisherman's Rest, had obtained possession of all the plans of this latest expedition. Armand Saint-Just, the Comte de Tournay, and other fugitive royalists were to have met the Scarlet Pimpernel, or rather, as it had been originally arranged, two of his emissaries, on this day, the 2nd of October, at a place evidently known to the League and vaguely alluded to as the Père Blanchard's hut. Armand, whose connection with the Scarlet Pimpernel and disavowal of the brutal policy of the Reign of Terror was still unknown to his countrymen, had left England a little more than a week ago, carrying with him the necessary instructions which would enable him to meet the other fugitives and to convey them to this place of safety. This much Marguerite had fully understood from the first, and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes had confirmed her surmises. She knew, too, that when Sir Percy realized that his own plans and his directions to his lieutenants had been stolen by Chauvelin, it was too late to communicate with Armand or to send fresh instructions to the fugitives. They would, of necessity, be at the appointed time and place, not knowing how grave was the danger which now awaited their brave rescuer. Blakeney, who, as usual, had planned and organized the whole expedition, would not allow any of his younger comrades to run the risk of almost certain capture. Hence his hurried note to them at Lord Grenville's ball: "Start myself tomorrow, alone." And now, with his identity known to his most bitter enemy, his every step would be dogged the moment he set foot in France. He would be tracked by Chauvelin's emissaries, followed until he reached that mysterious hut where the fugitives were waiting for him, and there the trap would be closed on him and on them. There was but 1 hour, the hour's start which Marguerite and Sir Andrew had of their enemy, in which to warn Percy of the imminence of his danger, and to persuade him to give up the foolhardy expedition which could only end in his death.
but there was that 1 hour.
"Chauvelin knows of this inn from the papers he stole," said Sir Andrew earnestly, "and on landing we'll make straight for it."
"He has not landed yet," she said. "We have an hour's start of him, and Percy will be here directly. We shall be mid-channel ere Chauvelin has realized that we have slipped through his fingers."
She spoke excitedly and eagerly, wishing to infuse into her young friend some of that buoyant hope which still clung to her heart. But he shook his head sadly.
"Silent again, Sir Andrew?" she said with some impatience. "Why do you shake your head and look so glum?"
"Faith, madame," he replied, "'tis only because in making your rose-coloured plans you are forgetting the most important factor."
"What in the world do you mean? I am forgetting nothing. What factor do you mean?" she added with more impatience.
"It stands 6 foot odd high," replied Sir Andrew quietly, "and hath name Percy Blakeney."
"I don't understand," she murmured.
"Do you think that Blakeney would leave Calais without having accomplished what he set out to do?"
"You mean—"
"There's the old Comte de Tournay."
"The Comte,"
she murmured, "and Saint-Just, and others."
"My brother," she said with a heartbroken sob of anguish. "Heaven help me, but I fear I had forgotten."
"Fugitives as they are, these men at this moment await with perfect confidence and unshaken faith the arrival of the Scarlet Pimpernel, who has pledged his honour to take them safely across the Channel." Indeed, she had forgotten. With the sublime selfishness of a woman who loves with her whole heart, she had, in the last 24 hours, had no thought save for him. His precious, noble life, his danger, he, the loved one, the brave hero, he alone dwelt in her mind.
"My brother," she murmured,
as one by one the heavy tears gathered in her eyes, as memory came back to her of Armand, the companion and darling of her childhood, the man for whom she had committed the deadly sin which had so hopelessly imperiled her brave husband's life.
"Sir Percy Blakeney would not be the trusted, honoured leader of a score of English gentlemen," said Sir Andrew proudly, "if he abandoned those who placed their trust in him. As for breaking his word, the very thought is preposterous."
There was silence for a moment or two. Marguerite had buried her face in her hands and was letting the tears slowly trickle through her trembling fingers. The young man said nothing. His heart ached for this beautiful woman in her awful grief. All along he had felt the terrible impasse in which her own rash act had plunged them all. He knew his friend and leader so well, with his reckless daring, his mad bravery, his worship of his own word of honour. Sir Andrew knew that Blakeney would brave any danger, run the wildest risks sooner than break it, and, with Chauvelin at his very heels, would make a final attempt, however desperate, to rescue those who trusted in him.
"Faith, Sir Andrew," said Marguerite at last, making brave efforts to dry her tears, "you are right, and I would not now shame myself by trying to persuade him from doing his duty. As you say, I should plead in vain. God grant him strength and ability," she added fervently and resolutely, "to outwit his pursuers. He will not refuse to take you with him, perhaps, when he starts on his noble work. Between you, you will have cunning as well as valour. God guard you both. In the meanwhile, I think we should lose no time. I still believe that his safety depends upon his knowing that Chauvelin is on his track."
"Undoubtedly. He has wonderful resources at his command. As soon as he is aware of his danger, he will exercise more caution. His ingenuity is a veritable miracle."
"Then, what say you to a voyage of reconnaissance in the village, whilst I wait here against his coming? You might come across Percy's track, and thus save valuable time. If you find him, tell him to beware. His bitterest enemy is on his heels."
"But this is such a villainous hole for you to wait in."
"Nay, that I do not mind. But you might ask our surly host if he could let me wait in another room, where I could be safer from the prying eyes of any chance traveller. Offer him some ready money, so that he should not fail to give me word the moment the tall Englishman returns."
She spoke quite calmly, even cheerfully now, thinking out her plans, ready for the worst if need be. She would show no more weakness. She would prove herself worthy of him who was about to give his life for the sake of his fellow men. Sir Andrew obeyed her without further comment. Instinctively he felt that hers now was the stronger mind. He was willing to give himself over to her guidance, to become the hand, whilst she was the directing head.
He went to the door of the inner room, through which Broga and his wife had disappeared before, and knocked. As usual, he was answered by a salvo of muttered oaths.
"Hey, friend Broga," said the young man peremptorily.
"My lady would wish to rest here a while. Could you give her the use of another room? She would wish to be alone."
He took some money out of his pocket and allowed it to jingle significantly in his hand. Broga had opened the door and listened with his usual surly apathy to the young man's request. At the sight of gold, however, his lazy attitude relaxed slightly. He took his pipe from his mouth and shuffled into the room. He then pointed over his shoulder at the attic up in the wall.
"She can wait up there," he said with a grunt. "It's comfortable, and I have no other room."
"Nothing could be better," said Marguerite in English. She at once realized the advantages such a position hidden from view would give her. "Give him the money, Sir Andrew. I shall be quite happy up there, and can see everything without being seen."
She nodded to Broga, who condescended to go up to the attic and to shake up the straw that lay on the floor.
"May I entreat you, madam, to do nothing rash," said Sir Andrew, as Marguerite prepared in her turn to ascend the rickety flight of steps. "Remember, this place is infested with spies. Do not, I beg of you, reveal yourself to Sir Percy unless you are absolutely certain that you are alone with him."
Even as he spoke, he felt how unnecessary was this caution. Marguerite was as calm, as clear-headed as any man. There was no fear of her doing anything that was rash.
"Nay," she said, with a slight attempt at cheerfulness, "that can I faithfully promise you. I would not jeopardize my husband's life, nor yet his plans, by speaking to him before strangers. Have no fear. I will watch my opportunity and serve him in the manner I think he needs it most."
Broga had come down the steps again, and Marguerite was ready to go up to her safe retreat.
"I dare not kiss your hand, madam," said Sir Andrew, as she began to mount the steps, "since I am your lackey. But I pray you to be of good cheer. If I do not come across Blakeney in half an hour, I shall return, expecting to find him here."
"Yes, that will be best. We can afford to wait for half an hour. Chauvelin cannot possibly be here before that. God grant that either you or I may have seen Percy by then. Good luck to you, friend. Have no fear for me."
Lightly she mounted the rickety wooden steps that led to the attic. Broga was taking no further heed of her. She could make herself comfortable there or not, as she chose. Sir Andrew watched her until she had reached the loft and sat down upon the straw. She pulled the tattered curtains across, and the young man noted that she was singularly well placed there for seeing and hearing whilst remaining unobserved. He had paid Broga well. The surly old innkeeper would have no object in betraying her. Then Sir Andrew prepared to go. At the door he turned once again and looked up at the loft. Through the ragged curtains Marguerite's sweet face was peeping down at him, and the young man rejoiced to see that it looked serene and even gently smiling. With a final nod of farewell to her, he walked out into the night.
Chapter 24 The Death Trap.
The next quarter of an hour went by swiftly and noiselessly. In the room downstairs, Broga had for a while busied himself with clearing the table and rearranging it for another guest. It was because she watched these preparations that Marguerite found the time slipping by more pleasantly. It was for Percy that this semblance of supper was being got ready. Evidently, Broga had a certain amount of respect for the tall Englishman, as he seemed to take some trouble in making the place look a trifle less uninviting than it had done before. He even produced, from some hidden recess in the old dresser, what actually looked like a tablecloth, and when he spread it out and saw it was full of holes, he shook his head dubiously for a while, then was at much pains so to spread it over the table as to hide most of its blemishes. Then he got out a serviette, also old and ragged, but possessing some measure of cleanliness, and with this he carefully wiped the glasses, spoons, and plates which he put on the table. Marguerite could not help smiling to herself as she watched all these preparations, which Broga accomplished to an accompaniment of muttered oaths. Clearly the great height and bulk of the Englishman, or perhaps the weight of his fist, had overawed this free-born citizen of France, or he would never have been at such trouble for any sacré aristo. When the table was set, such as it was,
Brogard surveyed it with evident satisfaction. He then dusted one of the chairs with the corner of his blouse, gave a stir to the stockpot, threw a fresh bundle of faggots onto the fire, and slouched out of the room. Marguerite was left alone with her reflections. She had spread her travelling cloak over the straw, and was sitting fairly comfortably, as the straw was fresh, and the evil odours from below came up to her only in a modified form. But, momentarily, she was almost happy. Happy because when she peeped through the tattered curtains, she could see a rickety chair, a torn tablecloth, a glass, a plate, and a spoon. That was all. But those mute and ugly things seemed to say to her that they were waiting for Percy, that soon, very soon, he would be here, that the squalid room being still empty, they would be alone together. That thought was so heavenly that Marguerite closed her eyes in order to shut out everything but that. In a few minutes she would be alone with him. She would run down the ladder and let him see her. Then he would take her in his arms, and she would let him see that, after that, she would gladly die for him and with him, for earth could hold no greater happiness than that. And then what would happen? She could not even remotely conjecture. She knew, of course, that Sir Andrew was right, that Percy would do everything he had set out to accomplish, that she, now she was here, could do nothing beyond warning him to be cautious, since Chauvelin himself was on his track. After having cautioned him, she would perforce have to see him go off upon his terrible and daring mission. She could not even, with a word or look, attempt to keep him back. She would have to obey whatever he told her to do, even perhaps have to efface herself and wait in indescribable agony, whilst he, perhaps, went to his death. But even that seemed less terrible to bear than the thought that he should never know how much she loved him. That, at any rate, would be spared her. The squalid room itself, which seemed to be waiting for him, told her that he would be here soon. Suddenly her oversensitive ears caught the sound of distant footsteps drawing near. Her heart gave a wild leap of joy. Was it Percy at last? No. The step did not seem quite as long, nor quite as firm as his. She also thought that she could hear two distinct sets of footsteps. Yes, that was it. Two men were coming this way. Two strangers, perhaps, to get a drink, or— But she had not time to conjecture, for presently there was a peremptory call at the door, and the next moment it was violently thrown open from the outside, whilst a rough, commanding voice shouted, "Hey, citoyen Brogard, hola!" Marguerite could not see the newcomers, but through a hole in one of the curtains she could observe one portion of the room below. She heard Brogard's shuffling footsteps as he came out of the inner room, muttering his usual string of oaths. On seeing the strangers, however, he paused in the middle of the room, well within range of Marguerite's vision, looked at them with even more withering contempt than he had bestowed upon his former guests, and muttered,
"Sacré soutane!"
Marguerite's heart seemed all at once to stop beating. Her eyes, large and dilated, had fastened on one of the newcomers, who, at this point, had taken a quick step forward towards Brogard. He was dressed in the soutane, broad-brimmed hat and buckled shoes habitual to the French curé. But as he stood opposite the innkeeper, he threw open his soutane for a moment, displaying the tricolour scarf of officialism, which sight immediately had the effect of transforming Brogard's attitude of contempt into one of cringing obsequiousness. It was the sight of this French curé which seemed to freeze the very blood in Marguerite's veins. She could not see his face, which was shaded by his broad-brimmed hat, but she recognized the thin, bony hands, the slight stoop, the whole gait of the man. It was Chauvelin. The horror of the situation struck her as with a physical blow. The awful disappointment, the dread of what was to come, made her very senses reel, and she needed almost superhuman effort not to fall senseless beneath it all. "A plate of soup and a bottle of wine," said Chauvelin imperiously to Brogard. "Then clear out of here, understand? I want to be alone." Silently, and without any muttering this time, Brogard obeyed. Chauvelin sat down at the table, which had been prepared for the tall Englishman, and the innkeeper busied himself obsequiously round him, dishing up the soup and pouring out the wine. The man who had entered with Chauvelin, and whom Marguerite could not see, stood waiting close by the door. At a brusque sign from Chauvelin, Brogard had hurried back to the inner room, and the former now beckoned to the man who had accompanied him. In him Marguerite at once recognized Degas, Chauvelin's secretary and confidential factotum, whom she had often seen in Paris in the days gone by. He crossed the room, and for a moment or two listened attentively at the Brogard's door.
"Not listening?" asked Chauvelin curtly.
"No, citoyen."
For a second, Marguerite dreaded lest Chauvelin should order Degas to search the place. What would happen if she were to be discovered, she hardly dared to imagine. Fortunately, however, Chauvelin seemed more impatient to talk to his secretary than afraid of spies, for he called Degas quickly back to his side.
"The English schooner?" he asked.
"She was lost sight of at sundown, citoyen," replied Degas, "but was then making west towards Cap Grinet."
"Ah, good," muttered Chauvelin. "And now, about Captain Jutley, what did he say?"
"He assured me that all the orders you sent him last week have been implicitly obeyed. All the roads which converge to this place have been patrolled night and day ever since, and the beach and cliffs have been most rigorously searched and guarded."
"Does he know where this Père Blanchard's hut is?"
"No, citoyen. Nobody seems to know of it by that name. There are any amount of fishermen's huts all along the coast, of course, but
that'll do. Now about tonight,"
interrupted Chauvelin impatiently.
"The roads and the beach are patrolled as usual, citoyen, and Captain Jutley awaits further orders."
"Go back to him at once, then. Tell him to send reinforcements to the various patrols, and especially to those along the beach. You understand?"
Chauvelin spoke curtly and to the point, and every word he uttered struck at Marguerite's heart like the death knell of her fondest hopes.
"The men," he continued, "are to keep the sharpest possible lookout for any stranger who may be walking, riding, or driving along the road or the beach, more especially for a tall stranger, whom I need not describe further, as probably he will be disguised. But he cannot very well conceal his height except by stooping. You understand?"
"Perfectly, citoyen," replied Degas.
"As soon as any of the men have sighted a stranger, two of them are to keep him in view. The man who loses sight of the tall stranger after he is once seen will pay for his negligence with his life. But one man is to ride straight back here and report to me. Is that clear?"
"Absolutely clear, citoyen."
"Very well, then. Go and see Jutley at once. See the reinforcements start off for the patrol duty, and then ask the captain to let you have half a dozen more men and bring them here with you. You can be back in 10 minutes. Go."
Degas saluted and went to the door. As Marguerite, sick with horror, listened to Chauvelin's directions to his underling, the whole of the plan for the capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel became appallingly clear to her. Chauvelin wished that the fugitives should be left in false security, waiting in their hidden retreat until Percy joined them. Then the daring plotter was to be surrounded and caught red-handed in the very act of aiding and abetting royalists who were traitors to the Republic. Thus, if his capture were noised abroad, even the British government could not legally protest in his favour. Having plotted with the enemies of the French government, France had the right to put him to death. Escape for him and them would be impossible. All the roads patrolled and watched, the trap well set, the net wide at present, but drawing together tighter and tighter, until it closed upon the daring plotter, whose superhuman cunning even could not rescue him from its meshes now. Degas was about to go, but Chauvelin once more called him back. Marguerite vaguely wondered what further devilish plans he could have formed in order to entrap one brave man alone against 20 of others. She looked at him as he turned to speak to Degas. She could just see his face beneath the broad-brimmed curé's hat. There was at that moment so much deadly hatred, such fiendish malice in the thin face and pale small eyes, that Marguerite's last hope died in her heart, for she felt that from this man she could expect no mercy. "I had forgotten," repeated Chauvelin with a weird chuckle, as he rubbed his bony, talon-like hands one against the other, with a gesture of fiendish satisfaction. "The tall stranger may show fight. In any case, no shooting, remember, except as a last resort. I want that tall stranger alive, if possible." He laughed, as Dante has told us that the devils laugh at sight of the torture of the damned. Marguerite had thought that by now she had lived through the whole gamut of horror and anguish that human heart could bear. Yet now, when Degas left the house and she remained alone in this lonely, squalid room with that fiend for company, she felt as if all that she had suffered was nothing compared with this. He continued to laugh and chuckle to himself for a while, rubbing his hands together in anticipation of his triumph. His plans were well laid, and he might well triumph. Not a loophole was left through which the bravest, the most cunning man might escape. Every road guarded, every corner watched, and in that lonely hut somewhere on the coast, a small band of fugitives waiting for their rescuer and leading him to his death. Nay, to worse than death. That fiend there, in a holy man's garb, was too much of a devil to allow a brave man to die the quick, sudden death of a soldier at the post of duty. He, above all, longed to have the cunning enemy who had so long baffled him helpless in his power. He wished to gloat over him, to enjoy his downfall, to inflict upon him what moral and mental torture a deadly hatred alone can devise. The brave eagle, captured and with noble wings clipped, was doomed to endure the gnawing of the rat. And she, his wife, who loved him, and who had brought him to this, could do nothing to help him. Nothing, save to hope for death by his side, and for one brief moment in which to tell him that her love, whole, true, and passionate, was entirely his. Chauvelin was now sitting close to the table. He had taken off his hat, and Marguerite could just see the outline of his thin profile and pointed chin as he bent over his meagre supper. He was evidently quite contented, and awaited events with perfect calm. He even seemed to enjoy Brogard's unsavoury fare. Marguerite wondered how so much hatred could lurk in one human being against another. Suddenly, as she watched Chauvelin, a sound caught her ear, which turned her very heart to stone. And yet that sound was not calculated to inspire anyone with horror, for it was merely the cheerful sound of a gay, fresh voice singing lustily, "God save the King." Chapter 25 The Eagle and the Fox. Marguerite's breath stopped short. She seemed to feel her very life standing still momentarily whilst she listened to that voice and to that song. In the singer she had recognized her husband. Chauvelin, too, had heard it, for he darted a quick glance towards the door, then hurriedly took up his broad-brimmed hat and clapped it over his head. The voice drew nearer. For one brief second the wild desire seized Marguerite to rush down the steps and fly across the room, to stop that song at any cost, to beg the cheerful singer to fly for his life before it be too late. She checked the impulse just in time. Chauvelin would stop her before she reached the door, and, moreover, she had no idea if he had any soldiers posted within his call. Her impetuous act might prove the death signal of the man she would have died to save.
"Long to reign over us, God save the King," sang the voice more lustily than ever.
The next moment the door was thrown open, and there was dead silence for a second or so. Marguerite could not see the door. She held her breath, trying to imagine what was happening. Percy Blakeney, on entering, had, of course, at once caught sight of the curé at the table. His hesitation lasted less than 5 seconds. The next moment Marguerite saw his tall figure crossing the room, whilst he called in a loud, cheerful voice,
"Hello there! No one about? Where's that fool Brogard?"
He wore the magnificent coat and riding suit which he had on when Marguerite last saw him at Richmond so many hours ago. As usual, his get-up was absolutely irreproachable. The fine Mechlin lace at his neck and wrists was immaculate in its gossamer daintiness. His hands looked slender and white. His fair hair was carefully brushed, and he carried his eyeglass with his usual affected gesture. In fact, at this moment, Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet, might have been on his way to a garden party of the Prince of Wales's, instead of deliberately, cold-bloodedly running his head in a trap set for him by his deadliest enemy. He stood for a moment in the middle of the room, whilst Marguerite, absolutely paralysed with horror, seemed unable even to breathe. Every moment she expected that Chauvelin would give a signal, that the place would fill with soldiers, that she would rush down and help Percy to sell his life dearly. As he stood there, suavely unconscious, she very nearly screamed out to him, "Fly, Percy, 'tis your deadly enemy, fly before it be too late." But she had not time even to do that, for the next moment Blakeney quietly walked to the table, and, jovially clapping the curé on the back, said in his own drawly, affected way,
"Odd's fish, Monsieur Chauvelin, I vow I never thought of meeting you here."
Chauvelin, who had been in the very act of conveying soup to his mouth, fairly choked. His thin face became absolutely purple, and a violent fit of coughing saved this cunning representative of France from betraying the most boundless surprise he had ever experienced. There was no doubt that this bold move on the part of the enemy had been wholly unexpected, as far as he was concerned, and the daring impudence of it completely nonplussed him for the moment. Obviously he had not taken the precaution of having the inn surrounded with soldiers. Blakeney had evidently guessed that much, and no doubt his resourceful brain had already formed some plan by which he could turn this unexpected interview to account. Marguerite, up in the loft, had not moved. She had made a solemn promise to Sir Andrew not to speak to her husband before strangers, and she had sufficient self-control not to throw herself unreasoningly and impulsively across his plans. To sit still and watch these two men together was a terrible trial of fortitude. Marguerite had heard Chauvelin give the orders for the patrolling of all the roads. She knew that if Percy now left the Chagri, in whichever direction he happened to go, he could not go far without being sighted by some of Captain Jutley's men on patrol. On the other hand, if he stayed, then Degas would have time to come back with the half-dozen men Chauvelin had specially ordered. The trap was closing in, and Marguerite could do nothing but watch and wonder. The two men looked such a strange contrast, and of the two it was Chauvelin who exhibited a slight touch of fear. Marguerite knew him well enough to guess what was passing in his mind. He had no fear for his own person, although he certainly was alone in a lonely inn with a man who was powerfully built, and who was daring and reckless beyond the bounds of probability. She knew that Chauvelin would willingly have braved perilous encounters for the sake of the cause he had at heart. But what he did fear was that this impudent Englishman would, by knocking him down, double his own chances of escape. His underlings might not succeed so well in capturing the Scarlet Pimpernel when not directed by the cunning hand and the shrewd brain which had deadly hate for an incentive. Evidently, however, the representative of the French government had nothing to fear for the moment at the hands of his powerful adversary. Blakeney, with his most inane laugh and pleasant good nature, was solemnly patting him on the back.
"I'm so damned sorry," he was saying cheerfully, "so very sorry. I seem to have upset you. Eating soup, too. Nasty, awkward thing, soup. Egad, a friend of mine died once. Choked, just like you, with a spoonful of soup."
And he smiled shyly, good-humouredly, down at Chauvelin.
"Odd's life,"
he continued, as soon as the latter had somewhat recovered himself.
"Beastly hole, this, ain't it now? And I don't mind,"
he added apologetically, as he sat down on a chair close to the table and drew the soup tureen towards him.
"That fool Brogard seems to be asleep or something."
There was a second plate on the table, and he calmly helped himself to soup, then poured himself out a glass of wine. For a moment Marguerite wondered what Chauvelin would do. His disguise was so good that perhaps he meant, on recovering himself, to deny his identity. But Chauvelin was too astute to make such an obviously false and childish move, and already he too had stretched out his hand and said pleasantly,
"I am indeed charmed to see you, Sir Percy. You must excuse me. I sought you the other side of the channel. Sudden surprise almost took my breath away."
"Hola," said Sir Percy with a good-humoured grin. "It did that quite, didn't it, Monsieur Chaubertin?"
"Pardon me, Chauvelin."
"I beg pardon a thousand times. Yes, Chauvelin, of course. I never could cotton to foreign names."
He was calmly eating his soup, laughing with pleasant good humour, as if he had come all the way to Calais for the express purpose of enjoying supper at this filthy inn in the company of his arch-enemy. For the moment, Marguerite wondered why Percy did not knock the little Frenchman down then and there, and, no doubt, something of the sort must have darted through his mind, for every now and then his lazy eyes seemed to flash ominously as they rested on the slight figure of Chauvelin, who had now quite recovered himself and was also calmly eating his soup. But the keen brain, which had planned and carried through so many daring plots, was too far-seeing to take unnecessary risks. This place, after all, might be infested with spies. The innkeeper might be in Chauvelin's pay. One call on Chauvelin's part might bring 20 men about Blakeney's ears, for aught he knew, and he might be caught and trapped before he could help, or at least warn, the fugitives. This he would not risk. He meant to help the others, to get them safely away, for he had pledged his word to them, and his word he would keep. And whilst he ate and chatted, he thought and planned, whilst, up in the loft, the poor anxious woman racked her brain as to what she should do, and endured agonies of longing to rush down to him, yet not daring to move for fear of upsetting his plans.
"I didn't know," Blakeney was saying jovially, "that you were in holy orders."
I stammered Chauvelin.
The calm impudence of his antagonist had evidently thrown him off his usual balance.
"But la, I should have known you anywhere,"
continued Sir Percy placidly, as he poured himself out another glass of wine,
"although the wig and hat have changed you a bit."
"Do you think so?"
"Oh, la, they alter a man so. But, begad, I hope you don't mind my having made the remark. Damned bad form making remarks. I hope you don't mind."
"Oh, no, no, not at all. I hope Lady Blakeney is well,"
said Chauvelin, hurriedly changing the topic of conversation. Blakeney, with much deliberation, finished his plate of soup, drank his glass of wine, and, momentarily, it seemed to Marguerite, as if he glanced quickly all round the room.
"Quite well, thank you,"
he said at last, dryly. There was a pause, during which Marguerite could watch these two antagonists who, evidently in their minds, were measuring themselves against one another. She could see Percy almost full face where he sat at the table, not 10 yards from where she herself was crouching, puzzled, not knowing what to do or what she should think. She had quite controlled her impulse by now of rushing down and disclosing herself to her husband. A man capable of acting a part in the way he was doing at the present moment did not need a woman's word to warn him to be cautious. Marguerite indulged in the luxury, dear to every tender woman's heart, of looking at the man she loved. She looked through the tattered curtain, across at the handsome face of her husband, in whose lazy blue eyes, and behind whose inane smile, she could now so plainly see the strength, energy, and resourcefulness which had caused the Scarlet Pimpernel to be reverenced and trusted by his followers.
"There are 19 of us ready to lay down our lives for your husband, Lady Blakeney," Sir Andrew had said to her. And as she looked at the forehead, low but square and broad, the eyes, blue yet deep-set and intense, the whole aspect of the man, of indomitable energy hiding behind a perfectly acted comedy, his almost superhuman strength of will and marvellous ingenuity, she understood the fascination which he exercised over his followers. For had he not also cast his spells over her heart and her imagination? Chauvelin, who was trying to conceal his impatience beneath his usual urbane manner, took a quick look at his watch. Degas should not be long. Another 2 or 3 minutes, and this impudent Englishman would be secure in the keeping of 6 of Captain Jutley's most trusted men.
"You are on your way to Paris, Sir Percy?" he asked carelessly.
"Odd's life, no," replied Blakeney with a laugh. "Only as far as Lille. Well, not Paris for me. Beastly uncomfortable place, Paris, just now, eh, Monsieur Chaubertin? Chauvelin?"
"Not for an English gentleman like yourself, Sir Percy," rejoined Chauvelin sarcastically, "who take no interest in the conflict that is raging there."
"La, you see, it's no business of mine, and our demmed government is all on your side of the business. Old Pitt Dent's a beau to a goose. You're in a hurry, sir?" he added, as Chauvelin once again took out his watch. "An appointment, perhaps? I pray you take no heed of me. My time's my own."
He rose from the table and dragged a chair to the hearth. Once more Marguerite was terribly tempted to go to him, for time was getting on. Degas might be back at any moment with his men. Percy did not know that, and, oh, how horrible it all was, and how helpless she felt.
"I'm in no hurry," continued Percy pleasantly. "But la, I don't want to spend any more time than I can help in this godforsaken hole. But begad, sir," he added, as Chauvelin had surreptitiously looked at his watch for the third time, "that watch of yours won't go any faster for all the looking you give it. You are expecting a friend, maybe?"
"Aye, a friend."
"Well, not a lady, I trust, Monsieur l'Abbé," laughed Blakeney. "Surely the Holy Church does not allow, eh? What?
But I say, come by the fire. It's getting damned cold."
He kicked the fire with the heel of his boot, making the logs blaze in the old hearth. He seemed in no hurry to go, and apparently was quite unconscious of his immediate danger. He dragged another chair to the fire, and Chauvelin, whose impatience was by now quite beyond control, sat down beside the hearth, in such a way as to command a view of the door. Degas had been gone nearly a quarter of an hour. It was quite plain to Marguerite's aching senses that as soon as he arrived, Chauvelin would abandon all his other plans with regard to the fugitives and capture this impudent Scarlet Pimpernel at once.
"Hey, Monsieur Chauvelin," the latter was saying airily, "tell me, I pray you, is your friend pretty? Damned smart, these little French women sometimes, what? But I protest I need not ask," he added, as he carelessly strode back towards the supper-table. "In matters of taste, the church has never been backward, eh?"
But Chauvelin was not listening. His every faculty was now concentrated on that door through which presently Degas would enter. Marguerite's thoughts, too, were centred there, for her ears had suddenly caught, through the stillness of the night, the sound of numerous and measured treads some distance away. It was Degas and his men. Another 3 minutes and they would be here. Another 3 minutes and the awful thing would have occurred. The brave eagle will have fallen in the ferret's trap. She would have moved now and screamed, but she dared not. For whilst she heard the soldiers approaching, she was looking at Percy and watching his every movement. He was standing by the table, where on the remnants of the supper, plates, glasses, spoons, salt and pepper pots were scattered pell-mell. His back was turned to Chauvelin, and he was still prattling along in his own affected and inane way, but from his pocket he had taken his snuff-box, and quickly and suddenly he emptied the contents of the pepper-pot into it. Then he again turned with an inane laugh to Chauvelin.
"Eh? Did you speak, sir?"
Chauvelin had been too intent on listening to the sound of those approaching footsteps to notice what his cunning adversary had been doing. He now pulled himself together, trying to look unconcerned in the very midst of his anticipated triumph.
"No," he said presently. "That is, as you were saying, Sir Percy—" "I was saying," said Blakeney, going up to Chauvelin by the fire, "that my man in Piccadilly has sold me better snuff this time than I have ever tasted. Will you honour me, Monsieur l'Abbé?"
He stood close to Chauvelin in his own careless, debonair way, holding out his snuff-box to his arch-enemy. Chauvelin, who, as he told Marguerite once, had seen a trick or two in his day, had never dreamed of this one. With one ear fixed on those fast-approaching footsteps, one eye turned to the door where Degas and his men would presently appear, lulled into false security by the impudent Englishman's airy manner, he never even remotely guessed the trick which was being played upon him. He took a pinch of snuff. Only he who has ever by accident sniffed vigorously a dose of pepper can have the faintest conception of the hopeless condition in which such a sniff would reduce any human being. Chauvelin felt as if his head would burst. Sneeze after sneeze seemed nearly to choke him. He was blind, deaf, and dumb for the moment, and during that moment Blakeney quietly, without the slightest haste, took up his hat, took some money out of his pocket, which he left on the table, then calmly stalked out of the room. Chapter 26. The Jew. It took Marguerite some time to collect her scattered senses. The whole of this last short episode had taken place in less than a minute, and Degas and the soldiers were still about 200 yards away from the Chargerie. When she realized what had happened, a curious mixture of joy and wonder filled her heart. It was all so neat, so ingenious. Chauvelin was still absolutely helpless, far more so than he could even have been under a blow from the fist, for now he could neither see, nor hear, nor speak, whilst his cunning adversary had quietly slipped through his fingers. Blakeney was gone, obviously to try and join the fugitives at the Père Blanchard's hut. For the moment, true, Chauvelin was helpless. For the moment the daring Scarlet Pimpernel had not been caught by Degas and his men. But all the roads and the beach were patrolled. Every place was watched, and every stranger kept in sight. How far could Percy go, thus arrayed in his gorgeous clothes, without being sighted and followed? Now she blamed herself terribly for not having gone down to him sooner, and given him that word of warning and of love which, perhaps, after all, he needed. He could not know of the orders which Chauvelin had given for his capture, and even now, perhaps. But before all these horrible thoughts had taken concrete form in her brain, she heard the grounding of arms outside, close to the door, and Degas' voice shouting, "Halt!" to his men. Chauvelin had partially recovered. His sneezing had become less violent, and he had struggled to his feet. He managed to reach the door just as Degas's knock was heard on the outside. Chauvelin threw open the door, and before his secretary could say a word, he had managed to stammer between two sneezes.
"The tall stranger, quick, did any of you see him?"
"Where, citoyen?" asked Degas in surprise.
"Here, man, through that door not 5 minutes ago."
"We saw nothing, citoyen. The moon is not yet up, and
you are just 5 minutes too late, my friend,"
said Chauvelin with concentrated fury.
"Oh, citoyen, you did what I ordered you to do," said Chauvelin with impatience. "I know that, but you were a precious long time about it. Fortunately, there's not much harm done, or it had fared ill with you, citoyen Degas."
Degas turned a little pale. There was so much rage and hatred in his superior's whole attitude.
"The tall stranger, citoyen," he stammered, "was here in this room 5 minutes ago having supper at that table. Damn his impudence. For obvious reasons I did not tackle him alone. Broga is too big a fool, and that cursed Englishman appears to have the strength of a bullock, and so he slipped away under your very nose. We cannot go far without being sighted, citoyen. Eh? Captain Jutley sent 40 men as reinforcements for the patrol duty. 20 went down to the beach. He again assured me that the watch has been constant all day, and that no stranger could possibly get to the beach or reach a boat without being sighted." "That's good. Do the men know their work?"
"They have had very clear orders, citoyen, and I myself spoke to those who are about to start. They are to shadow, as secretly as possible, any stranger they may see, especially if he be tall, or stoop, as if he would disguise his height."
"In no case to detain such a person, of course," said Chauvelin eagerly. "That impudent Scarlet Pimpernel would slip through clumsy fingers. We must let him get to the Père Blanchard's hut now, there surround and capture him."
"The men understand that, citoyen. And also that, as soon as a tall stranger has been sighted, he must be shadowed, whilst one man is to turn straight back and report to you."
"That is right," said Chauvelin, rubbing his hands, well pleased. "I have further news for you, citoyen."
"What is it?"
"A tall Englishman had a long conversation about 3/4 of an hour ago with a Jew, Reuben by name, who lives not 10 paces from here."
"Yes, and?"
queried Chauvelin impatiently.
"The conversation was all about a horse and cart, which the tall Englishman wished to hire, and which was to have been ready for him by 11 o'clock.
"Well, it is past that now. Where does that Reuben live?"
"A few minutes' walk from this door."
"Send one of the men to find out if the stranger has driven off in Reuben's cart."
"Yes, citoyen."
Degas went to give the necessary orders to one of the men. Not a word of this conversation between him and Chauvelin had escaped Marguerite, and every word they had spoken seemed to strike at her heart with terrible hopelessness and dark foreboding. She had come all this way, and with such high hopes and firm determination to help her husband, and so far she had been able to do nothing but to watch, with a heart breaking with anguish, the meshes of the deadly net closing round the daring Scarlet Pimpernel. He could not now advance many steps without spying eyes to track and denounce him. Her own helplessness struck her with the terrible sense of utter disappointment. The possibility of being of the slightest use to her husband had become almost nil, and her only hope rested in being allowed to share his fate, whatever it might ultimately be. For the moment, even her chance of ever seeing the man she loved again had become a remote one. Still, she was determined to keep a close watch over his enemy, and a vague hope filled her heart that whilst she kept Chauvelin in sight, Percy's fate might still be hanging in the balance. Degas had left Chauvelin moodily pacing up and down the room, whilst he himself waited outside for the return of the man whom he had sent in search of Reuben. Thus several minutes went by. Chauvelin was evidently devoured with impatience. Apparently he trusted no one. This last trick played upon him by the daring Scarlet Pimpernel had made him suddenly doubtful of success, unless he himself was there to watch, direct, and superintend the capture of this impudent Englishman. About 5 minutes later Degas returned, followed by an elderly Jew in a dirty, threadbare gabardine worn greasy across the shoulders. His red hair, which he wore after the fashion of the Polish Jews, with the corkscrew curls each side of his face, was plentifully sprinkled with grey. A general coating of grime about his cheeks and chin gave him a peculiarly dirty appearance. He walked behind Degas with a stoop and a shuffling gait. Chauvelin,
who had all the Frenchman's prejudice against the despised race, motioned to the fellow to keep at a respectful distance. The group of the three men were standing just underneath the hanging oil lamp, and Marguerite had a clear view of them all.
"Is this the man?" asked Chauvelin.
"No, citoyen," replied Degas. "Reuben could not be found, so presumably his cart has gone with the stranger. But this man here seems to know something, which he is willing to sell for a consideration."
"Ah," said Chauvelin.
The Jew stood humbly on one side, leaning on a thick knotted staff, his greasy, broad-brimmed hat casting a deep shadow over his grimy face, waiting for the noble excellency to deign to put some questions to him.
"The citoyen tells me," said Chauvelin peremptorily to him, "that you know something of my friend, the tall Englishman whom I desire to meet." "Oh, morbleu, keep your distance, man," he added hurriedly, as the Jew took a quick and eager step forward.
"Yes, your excellency," replied the Jew.
"I and Reuben Goldstein met a tall Englishman on the road close by here this evening."
"Did you speak to him?"
"Well, he spoke to us, your excellency. He wanted to know if he could hire a horse and cart to go down along the St. Martin Road to a place he wanted to reach tonight."
"What did you say?"
"Well, I did not say anything," said the Jew in an injured tone. "Reuben Goldstein, that accursed traitor, that son of Belial—"
"Cut that short, man," interrupted Chauvelin roughly, "and go on with your story."
"He took the words out of my mouth, your excellency. When I was about to offer the wealthy Englishman my horse and cart to take him wheresoever he chose, Reuben had already spoken and offered his half-starved nag and his broken-down cart."
"And what did the Englishman do?"
"He listened to Reuben Goldstein, your excellency, and put his hand in his pocket then and there, and took out a handful of gold, which he showed to that descendant of Beelzebub, telling him that all would be his if the horse and cart were ready for him by 11 o'clock.
"And, of course, the horse and cart were ready?"
"Well, they were ready in a manner, so to speak, your excellency. Reuben's nag was lame as usual. She refused to budge at first. It was only after a time and with plenty of kicks that she at last could be made to move," said the Jew with a malicious chuckle.
"Then they started?"
"Yes, they started about 5 minutes ago. I was disgusted with that stranger's folly. An Englishman, too. He ought to have known Reuben's nag was not fit to drive."
"But if he had no choice?"
"No choice, your excellency," protested the Jew in a rasping voice. "Did I not repeat to him 12 times that my horse and cart would take him quicker and more comfortably than Reuben's bag of bones? He would not listen. Reuben is such a liar and has such insinuating ways. The stranger was deceived. If he was in a hurry, he would have had better value for his money by taking my cart."
"You have a horse and cart too, then?" asked Chauvelin peremptorily.
"Aye, that I have, your excellency. And if your excellency wants to drive—"
"Do you happen to know which way my friend went in Reuben Goldstein's cart?"
Thoughtfully the Jew rubbed his chin. Marguerite's heart was beating well nigh to bursting. She had heard the peremptory question. She looked anxiously at the Jew, but could not read his face beneath the shadow of his broad-brimmed hat. Vaguely she felt somehow as if he held Percy's fate in his long, dirty hands. There was a long pause, whilst Chauvelin frowned impatiently at the stooping figure before him. At last the Jew slowly put his hand in his breast pocket and drew out from its capacious depths a number of silver coins. He gazed at them thoughtfully, then remarked in a quiet tone of voice,
"This is what the tall stranger gave me when he drove away with Reuben for holding my tongue about him and his doings."
Chauvelin shrugged his shoulders impatiently.
"How much is there?" he asked.
20 francs, your excellency," replied the Jew, "and I have been an honest man all my life."
Chauvelin, without further comment, took a few pieces of gold out of his own pocket, and leaving them in the palm of his hand, he allowed them to jingle as he held them out towards the Jew.
"How many gold pieces are there in the palm of my hand?" he asked quietly.
Evidently he had no desire to terrorize the man, but to conciliate him, for his own purposes, for his manner was pleasant and suave. No doubt he feared that threats of the guillotine and various other persuasive methods of that type might addle the old man's brains, and that he would be more likely to be useful through greed of gain than through terror of death. The eyes of the Jew shot a quick, keen glance at the gold in his interlocutor's hand.
"At least 5, I should say, your excellency," he replied obsequiously. "Enough, do you think, to loosen that honest tongue of yours?"
What does your excellency wish to know?
Whether your horse and cart can take me to where I can find my friend, the tall stranger who has driven off in Reuben Goldstein's cart.
My horse and cart can take your honour there, where you please.
To a place called the Père Blanchard's hut?
Your honour has guessed, said the Jew in astonishment.
You know the place?
Well, I know it, your honour.
Which road leads to it?
The St. Martin Road, your honour. Then a footpath from there to the cliffs.
You know the road? Repeated Chauvelin roughly.
Every stone, every blade of grass, your honour, replied the Jew quietly.
Chauvelin, without another word, threw the 5 pieces of gold one by one before the Jew, who knelt down and on his hands and knees struggled to collect them. One rolled away, and he had some trouble to get it, for it had lodged underneath the dresser. Chauvelin quietly waited, while the old man scrambled on the floor to find the piece of gold. When the Jew was again on his feet, Chauvelin said,
"How soon can your horse and cart be ready?"
"Well, they are ready now, your honour."
"Where?"
"Not 10 meters from this door. Will your excellency deign to look?"
"I don't want to see it. How far can you drive me in it?"
"As far as the Père Blanchard's hut, your honour, and further than Rubensnag took your friend. I'm sure that not 2 leagues from here we shall come across that wily Reuben, his nag, his cart, and a tall stranger all in a heap in the middle of the road."
"How far is the nearest village from here?"
"On the road which the Englishman took? Miquelon is the nearest village, not 2 leagues from here."
"There he could get fresh conveyance if he wanted to go further?"
"He could, if he ever got so far."
"Can you?"
"Will your excellency try?" said the Jew simply.
"That is my intention," said Chauvelin very quietly. "But remember, if you have deceived me, I shall tell off 2 of my most stalwart soldiers to give you such a beating that your breath will perhaps leave your ugly body forever. But if we find my friend, the tall Englishman, either on the road or at the Père Blanchard's hut, there will be 10 more gold pieces for you. Do you accept the bargain?"
The Jew again thoughtfully rubbed his chin. He looked at the money in his hand, then at his stern interlocutor, and at Degas, who had stood silently behind him all this while. After a moment's pause, he said deliberately,
"I accept."
"Go and wait outside, then," said Chauvelin, "and remember to stick to your bargain, or by heaven I will keep to mine."
With a final, most abject and cringing bow, the old Jew shuffled out of the room. Chauvelin seemed pleased with the interview, for he rubbed his hands together with that usual gesture of his of malignant satisfaction.
"My coat and boots," he said to Degas at last.
Degas went to the door and apparently gave the necessary orders, for presently a soldier entered, carrying Chauvelin's coat, boots, and hat. He took off his soutane, beneath which he was wearing close-fitting breeches and a cloth waistcoat, and began changing his attire.
"You, citoyen, in the meanwhile," he said to Degas, "go back to Captain Jutley as fast as you can, and tell him to let you have another 12 men, and bring them with you along the St. Martin Road, where I dare say you will soon overtake the Jew's cart with myself in it. There will be hot work presently, if I mistake not, in the Père Blanchard's hut. We shall corner our game there, I'll warrant, for this impudent Scarlet Pimpernel has had the audacity, or the stupidity, I hardly know which, to adhere to his original plans. He has gone to meet de Tournay, Saint-Just, and the other traitors, which, for the moment, I thought perhaps he did not intend to do. When we find them, there will be a band of desperate men at bay. Some of our men will, I presume, be put hors de combat. These royalists are good swordsmen, and the Englishman is devilish cunning and looks very powerful. Still, we shall be 5 against 1 at least. You can follow the cart closely with your men all along the Saint-Martin Road through Miquelon. The Englishman is ahead of us, and not likely to look behind him."
Whilst he gave these curt and concise orders, he had completed his change of attire. The priest's costume had been laid aside, and he was once more dressed in his usual dark, tight-fitting clothes. At last he took up his hat.
"I shall have an interesting prisoner to deliver into your hands," he said with a chuckle, as with unwonted familiarity he took Degas' arm and led him towards the door. "We won't kill him outright, eh, friend Degas? The Père Blanchard's hut is, and I mistake not, a lonely spot upon the beach, and our men will enjoy a bit of rough sport there with the wounded fox. Choose your men well, friend Degas, of the sort who would enjoy that type of sport, eh?
We must see that Scarlet Pimpernel wither a bit, what? Shrink and tremble, eh? Before we finally...
He made an expressive gesture whilst he laughed a low, evil laugh, which filled Marguerite's soul with sickening horror.
"Choose your men well, Citoyen Degas," he said once more, as he led his secretary finally out of the room.
Chapter 27 On the Track. Never for a moment did Marguerite Blakeney hesitate. The last sounds outside the Chagri had died away in the night. She had heard Degas giving orders to his men, and then starting off towards the fort to get a reinforcement of a dozen more men. Six were not thought sufficient to capture the cunning Englishman, whose resourceful brain was even more dangerous than his valour and his strength.
Then, a few minutes later, she heard the Jew's husky voice again, evidently shouting to his nag. Then the rumble of wheels and noise of a rickety cart bumping over the rough road. Inside the inn, everything was still. Broga and his wife, terrified of Chauvelin, had given no sign of life. They hoped to be forgotten, and at any rate to remain unperceived. Marguerite could not even hear their usual volleys of muttered oaths. She waited a moment or two longer, then she quietly slipped down the broken stairs, wrapped her dark cloak closely round her, and slipped out of the inn. The night was fairly dark, sufficiently so at any rate to hide her dark figure from view, whilst her keen ears kept count of the sound of the cart going on ahead. She hoped, by keeping well within the shadow of the ditches which lined the road, that she would not be seen by Degas' men when they approached, or by the patrols which she concluded were still on duty. Thus she started to do this, the last stage of her weary journey, alone, at night, and on foot. Nearly 3 leagues to Miquelon, then on to the Père Blanchard's hut, wherever that fatal spot might be, probably over rough roads. She cared not. The Jew's nag could not get on very fast, and though she was weary with mental fatigue and nerve strain, she knew that she could easily keep up with it, on a hilly road, where the poor beast, who was sure to be half-starved, would have to be allowed long and frequent rests. The road lay some distance from the sea, bordered on either side by shrubs and stunted trees, sparsely covered with meagre foliage, all turning away from the north, with their branches looking in the semi-darkness like stiff, ghostly hair blown by a perpetual wind. Fortunately, the moon showed no desire to peep between the clouds, and Marguerite, hugging the edge of the road and keeping close to the low line of shrubs, was fairly safe from view. Everything around her was so still. Only from far, very far away, there came a long, soft moan, the sound of the distant sea. The air was keen and full of brine. After that enforced period of inactivity inside the evil-smelling, squalid inn, Marguerite would have enjoyed the sweet scent of this autumnal night, and the distant, melancholy rumble of the waves. She would have revelled in the calm and stillness of this lonely spot, a calm broken only at intervals by the strident and mournful cry of some distant gull, and by the creaking of the wheels some way down the road. She would have loved the cool atmosphere, the peaceful immensity of nature in this lonely part of the coast. But her heart was too full of cruel foreboding, of a great ache and longing for a being who had become infinitely dear to her. Her feet slipped on the grassy bank, for she thought it safest not to walk near the centre of the road, and she found it difficult to keep up a sharp pace along the muddy incline. She even thought it best not to keep too near to the cart. Everything was so still that the rumble of the wheels could not fail to be a safe guide. The loneliness was absolute. Already the few dim lights of Calais lay far behind, and on this road there was not a sign of human habitation, not even the hut of a fisherman or of a woodcutter anywhere near. Far away on her right was the edge of the cliff. Below it the rough beach, against which the incoming tide was dashing itself with its constant, distant murmur. And ahead the rumble of the wheels bearing an implacable enemy to his triumph. Marguerite wondered at what particular spot on this lonely coast Percy could be at this moment. Not very far, surely, for he had had less than a quarter of an hour's start of Chauvelin. She wondered if he knew that in this cool, ocean-scented bit of France there lurked many spies, all eager to sight his tall figure, to track him to where his unsuspecting friends waited for him, and then to close the net over him and them. Chauvelin, on ahead, jolted and jostled in the Jew's vehicle, was nursing comfortable thoughts. He rubbed his hands together with content,
as he thought of the web which he had woven, and through which that ubiquitous and daring Englishman could not hope to escape. As the time went on, and the old Jew drove him leisurely but surely along the dark road, he felt more and more eager for the grand finale of this exciting chase after the mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel. The capture of the audacious plotter would be the finest leaf in Citoyen Chauvelin's wreath of glory. Caught red-handed on the spot, in the very act of aiding and abetting the traitors against the Republic of France, the Englishman could claim no protection from his own country. Chauvelin had, in any case, fully made up his mind that all intervention should come too late. Never for a moment did the slightest remorse enter his heart as to the terrible position in which he had placed the unfortunate wife, who had unconsciously betrayed her husband. As a matter of fact, Chauvelin had ceased even to think of her. She had been a useful tool, that was all. The Jew's lean nag did little more than walk. She was going along at a slow jog-trot, and her driver had to give her long and frequent halts.
"Are we a long way yet from Miquelon?" asked Chauvelin from time to time.
"Not very far, Your Honour," was the uniform, placid reply.
"We have not yet come across your friend and mine lying in a heap in the roadway," was Chauvelin's sarcastic comment.
"Patience, noble excellency," rejoined the son of Moses. "They are ahead of us. I can see the imprint of the cartwheels driven by that traitor, that son of the Amalekite."
"You are sure of the road?"
"As sure as I am of the presence of those 10 gold pieces in the noble excellency's pockets, which I trust will presently be mine. As soon as I have shaken hands with my friend, the tall stranger, they will certainly be yours."
"Hark! What was that?" said the Jew suddenly.
Through the stillness, which had been absolute, there could now be heard distinctly the sound of horses' hoofs on the muddy road.
"They are soldiers," he added in an awed whisper.
"Stop a moment, I want to hear," said Chauvelin.
Marguerite had also heard the sound of galloping hoofs coming towards the cart and towards herself. For some time she had been on the alert, thinking that Degas and his squad would soon overtake them. But these came from the opposite direction, presumably from Miquelon. The darkness lent her sufficient cover. She had perceived that the cart had stopped, and, with utmost caution, treading noiselessly on the soft road, she crept a little nearer. Her heart was beating fast. She was trembling in every limb. Already she had guessed what news these mounted men would bring. Every stranger on these roads or on the beach must be shadowed, especially if he be tall or stoops as if he would disguise his height. When sighted, a mounted messenger must at once ride back and report. Those had been Chauvelin's orders. Had then the tall stranger been sighted? And was this the mounted messenger, come to bring the great news that the hunted hare had run its head into the noose at last? Marguerite, realizing that the cart had come to a standstill, managed to slip nearer to it in the darkness. She crept close up, hoping to get within earshot, to hear what the messenger had to say. She heard the quick words of challenge. "Liberté, fraternité, égalité," then Chauvelin's quick query.
"What news?"
Two men on horseback had halted beside the vehicle. Marguerite could see them silhouetted against the midnight sky. She could hear their voices and the snorting of their horses. And now, behind her, some little distance off, the regular and measured tread of a body of advancing men, Degas and his soldiers. There had been a long pause, during which, no doubt, Chauvelin satisfied the men as to his identity, for presently questions and answers followed each other in quick succession.
"You have seen the stranger?" asked Chauvelin eagerly. "No, citoyen, we have seen no tall stranger. We came by the edge of the cliff."
"Then?"
"Less than a quarter of a league beyond Miquelon, we came across a rough construction of wood, which looked like the hut of a fisherman, where he might keep his tools and nets. When we first sighted it, it seemed to be empty, and at first we thought that there was nothing suspicious about it, until we saw some smoke issuing through an aperture at the side. I dismounted and crept close to it. It was then empty, but in one corner of the hut there was a charcoal fire, and a couple of stools were also in the hut. I consulted with my comrades, and we decided that they should take cover with the horses well out of sight, and that I should remain on the watch, which I did."
"Well, and did you see anything?"
"About half an hour later I heard voices, citoyen, and presently two men came along towards the edge of the cliff. They seemed to me to have come from the Lille road. One was young, the other quite old.
They were talking in a whisper to one another, and I could not hear what they said.
One was young, the other quite old. Marguerite's aching heart almost stopped beating as she listened. Was the young one Armand, her brother, and the old one de Tournay? Were they the two fugitives who, unconsciously, were used as a decoy to entrap their fearless and noble rescuer?
The two men presently went into the hut,
continued the soldier, whilst Marguerite's aching nerve seemed to catch the sound of Chauvelin's triumphant chuckle,
and I crept nearer to it then. The hut is very roughly built, and I caught snatches of their conversation.
Yes, quick, what did you hear?
The old man asked the young one if he was sure that was the right place. Oh yes, he replied, 'tis the place sure enough, and by the light of the charcoal fire he showed to his companion a paper which he carried. Here is the plan, he said, which he gave me before I left London. We were to adhere strictly to that plan unless I had contrary orders, and I have had none. Here is the road we followed, see? Here the fork, here we cut across the Saint-Martin road, and here is the footpath which brought us to the edge of the cliff. I must have made a slight noise then, for the young man came to the door of the hut and peered anxiously all round him. When he again joined his companion, they whispered so low that I could no longer hear them.
Well, and? Asked Chauvelin impatiently.
There were six of us altogether, patrolling that part of the beach. So we consulted together and thought it best that four should remain behind and keep the hut in sight, and I and my comrade rode back at once to make report of what we had seen.
You saw nothing of the tall stranger?
Oh, nothing, citoyen.
If your comrades see him, what would they do?
Or not lose sight of him for a moment. And if he showed signs of escape or any boat came in sight, they would close in on him and, if necessary, they would shoot. The firing would bring the rest of the patrol to the spot. In any case, they would not let the stranger go.
Aye, but I did not want the stranger hurt, not just yet, murmured Chauvelin savagely.
But there, you've done your best. The fates grant that I may not be too late. We met half a dozen men just now who have been patrolling this road for several hours.
Well,
they have seen no stranger either.
Yet he is on ahead somewhere in a cart, or else...
Here, there is not a moment to lose. How far is that hut from here?
About a couple of leagues, citoyen.
You can find it again, at once, without hesitation?
I have absolutely no doubt, citoyen.
The footpath to the edge of the cliff, even in the dark?
Oh, it is not a dark night, citoyen, and I know I can find my way, repeated the soldier firmly.
Fall in behind, then. Let your comrade take both your horses back to Calais. You won't want them. Keep beside the cart and direct the Jew to drive straight ahead. Then stop him within a quarter of a league of the footpath. See that he takes the most direct road.
Whilst Chauvelin spoke, Degas and his men were fast approaching, and Marguerite could hear their footsteps within 100 yards behind her now. She thought it unsafe to stay where she was, and unnecessary, too, as she had heard enough. She seemed suddenly to have lost all faculty even for suffering. Her heart, her nerves, her brain seemed to have become numb after all these hours of ceaseless anguish, culminating in this awful despair. For now there was absolutely not the faintest hope. Within 2 short leagues of this spot, the fugitives were waiting for their brave deliverer. He was on his way, somewhere on this lonely road, and presently he would join them. Then the well-laid trap would close. 2 dozen men, led by one whose hatred was as deadly as his cunning was malicious, would close round the small band of fugitives and their daring leader. They would all be captured. Armand, according to Chauvelin's pledged word, would be restored to her. But her husband Percy, whom with every breath she drew she seemed to love and worship more and more, he would fall into the hands of a remorseless enemy who had no pity for a brave heart, no admiration for the courage of a noble soul, who would show nothing but hatred for the cunning antagonist who had baffled him so long. She heard the soldier giving a few brief directions to the Jew, then she retired quickly to the edge of the road and cowered behind some low shrubs, whilst Degas and his men came up. All fell in noiselessly behind the cart, and slowly they all started down the dark road. Marguerite waited until she reckoned that they were well outside the range of earshot, then she, too, in the darkness, which suddenly seemed to have become more intense, crept noiselessly along.